everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, June 17th, 2022. As always, thank you to Ron Trammell and the Cats Tribute Band for our bluesy intro music. The weather here in Nashville has been brutal this week, with temperatures approaching 100 degrees for several days straight. I hope everyone will stay safe and stay out of the heat. And just as I am recording this introduction, a strong storm is passing through Nashville, giving us some much-needed rainfall. Perhaps you can hear the chainsaws at work in our neighborhood as neighbors clean up after the storm. We have reported several times in this podcast that visitation to our state and local parks has skyrocketed during the pandemic, with citizens seeking a safe way to get out of the house and experience a little bit of freedom in the out-of-doors. Now that the pandemic is on the wane, the visitation has calmed down, but is still remaining high. This is, of course, putting a strain on park management. Visitor safety is, of course, a paramount concern for park management, and at the center of assuring visitor safety are the 250 park rangers employed by our Tennessee State Parks. And we have interviewed several of these remarkable people over the 5 years we have been doing this podcast. Today we have a chat with my friend Shane Petty, who for the past 25 years has been the chief of the Tennessee Ranger Service. Shane is the guy responsible for recruiting, hiring, and training of our rangers, as well as coordinating emergency response within the state parks. As you will hear, Shane has an interesting story. He had a childhood experience in a Tennessee state park, which changed his life, and he has managed to fulfill his childhood ambition in his work. Shane's leadership has been essential to maintaining esprit de corps among the rangers, and has developed so many family-like connections with rangers past and present. He also is highly regarded for his tracking skills and his training of bloodhounds. And we will get started with our interview right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish 6 beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Shane Petty, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hey, Mark, thanks for having me. Appreciate it, buddy.
Shane, it's great to talk with you. And this is long overdue. You and I had a meeting at McCabe's Pub here a couple years ago and got to know each other a little bit. And at that time, I was definitely interested in getting you on the show and talking with you about what you're up to. And then the pandemic hit, and all plans and circumstances changed. But recently decided, well, I'm, you know, gotten to be able to do these meetings via Zoom without too much inconvenience to anybody. And so let me give Shane a call It's long overdue, so really glad to have you. And I understand that you are coming to us from your boat.
From my remote location, sure. We have a houseboat at Timms Ford State Park. So
at Timms Ford.
Or Timms Ford Lake. And so that is our getaway. We're on vacation this week, been fishing and chasing grandbabies. And so it's coming to an end, especially with the heat. I've decided outdoor activity is about too much right now.
Well, it is brutal out there today. It's, you know, way above 95 here in Nashville. I'm sure the same down there.
Sure.
And it's best for everybody to be in the shade, for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, Shane, you know, one of the things that we do in this program is talk about people in conservation and their careers. And we always ask our guests to talk, share with the audience a little bit about What inspired you to become part of the field of conservation and parks and recreation? You're You're now the chief ranger for the state park system, which we'll talk about that in great detail. And you've come up through the ranks in that agency over some several decades now. But what was it that inspired you to get into that as a career?
Well, really kind of like anybody, it's kind of a storybook. As a young kid, my family would we take little small vacations over to Henry Horton State Park. I lived in Columbia, Tennessee, so as about a 11 and 12 year old kid, we would come over and stay, and of course stay in the hotel, and you have activities, swimming pool, and things like that. But all of a sudden, I wandered over to the conference lodge, or the recreation lodge, as we called it back then. And I fell into the world of interpretive recreational programming. And I found all the programs. And I was in heaven. So I won the checker contest. I won the shuffleboard contest. The watermelon eating contest. Then later on that night, won the square dance contest. And I was in heaven. I mean, it was just wow that getting to meet the seasonal recreators, that was part of their job that most of us did during college. And I just thought, man, how cool would it be to have a career doing that? Simultaneously, ironically, and life-changing, during that same time, I met a horse-mounted ranger. And that changed my life forever. That put me on a focus that I never stopped. I came back to the hotel and I told my mom, I know what I'll do for the rest of my life. I want to be a horseman ranger at Henry Horton State Park.
Do you remember who that individual was that you met?
You know, I can't. And I've tried to find, not really sure from the dates. I've asked as many folks and I really couldn't get it narrowed down. I also asked Charlie Tate. I tried to find out who the seasonals were. I wanted to reach out. I remember there was a male and a female, but really didn't have any records to be able to go back that far.
Right.
When we left there, that passion just never left me. And I started in with the Columbia Parks and Recreation, City of Columbia, there with Ronnie Norton years ago. And
an old buddy of mine, now deceased, unfortunately.
Yes. Ended up being a great friend of mine. And he gave me my first job. And he said, boy, this is going to be tough. You're going to pick up cigarette butts. You're going to clean bathrooms. You're going to pick up trash. Then you're going to weed eat. And then you'll.
So, Shane, we were interrupted by an outage here on our connection. And you were talking about your early days and getting started with the Columbia Park and Recreation Agency and their director, Ronnie Norton, at the time.
Sure. And so I started out as what we call it. I actually started a Facebook page a few years ago in tribute to Ronnie.
I would love to see that. I'll have to look for that.
And we call it Ronnie's Raiders. An older friend of mine stopped by one day when we were swing blade around Riverside, down on the riverbank. And that's, he said, well, there's another group of Ronnie's Rangers. And of course, this gentleman had been a Ronnie's Rangers. Ronnie employed so many young men over the years, to work in the summer program. So I started there around 15 years of age, and I did that all through high school and actually through junior college at Columbia State. And as I went on to got my associate's degree from Columbia State in animal and plant science, I went to MTSU, and my goal was still to be a horse mounted ranger, work with Tennessee State Parks. I found out about their seasonal interpretive ranger program, became an SIR like many of us are, of course, hired by Charlie Tate, Dare Bible, and, of course, everybody's hero, Bobby Fulcher. And
yes, exactly.
That was it, and then got to sit in that first SIR meeting with Matt Pritchard, and that changed my whole life again, of just hearing Matt tell the stories. And I've heard, as you, I'm sure, we've heard those same stories year after year, and they're always still inspiring, recharge our batteries for many years of spending time with Matt. And so I became a seasonal ranger at Cedars 11 State Park. And then soon after graduation, I was hired as a ranger at Henry Horton in 1989. And not long after that, who would think it, I became a horse mounted ranger at Henry Horton State Park.
Good
so
for you.
There are not
you.
Too many people that have a childhood dream and it come true exactly at the time and place. And so I became a state ranger there at Henry Horton for about 7 years. And then at the time, the chief ranger, Bob Reese, decided to leave the position and go to be the park manager at Tim's Ford. And my boss, superintendent at the time in Henry Horton, Ed Schoenberger.
I remember Ed, he and certainly.
Put together a proposal to put the chief ranger program. Actually, we did simultaneously. He became chief ranger and superintendent at Horton. I was a ranger at Henry Horton and an assistant chief ranger for the whole state. And then another ranger, Ray Ferris, came on to do the same thing. So we did double duty for a while.
Right.
And our hopes were to get it off on a full-time campaign. And right when we were getting a chance, Ed unfortunately found out he had cancer. And right. He fought it for several years, succumbed to that. And then I was able to interview and get the position as chief ranger after that. And we built on that program from there. And that was around, I took over July 1 of 1997. So this July 1 I will be a chief ranger for 25 years.
Fantastic. Now, let's let our audience in on exactly what that means to be a chief ranger. You know, the Tennessee State Parks Division has, well, you may be able to actually tell me the actual numbers, but we have numerous people who are commissioned law enforcement officers, and it's in effect a police department.
Absolutely. I become a chief of police or a sheriff, you know, if people can relate to that a little bit better.
It's really one of the requirements of having a police department is to have a chief.
Sure, exactly. Right. So I oversee 250 commissioned officers within our state. My job is to assist with hiring, then training, procurement, putting uniforms on them. We get them ready for the police academy. They go to the police academy just as any city, county police officer does.
Right.
Now it's a 12-week class. And then we will do all the post-training, the medical training. We have to do 40 hours of in-service training every year, law enforcement-wise, every officer in the state of Tennessee does.
Right.
So my job is to do the initial training and the continual training of rangers. So I pretty much have a hand in everything that a ranger does from the day they begin until the day they retire. Then I get all their uniforms back and receipt their gun. You know, you give them their equipment, then you take it back at the end. And in between that, a lot of my job is I'm over emergency operations. So we have several special operations divisions. One would be horse mounted, canine, high angle rescue, our fire teams, our search and rescue teams. And so I oversee those special operation teams. So this time of year, when the parks are really busy, certainly we don't do any training. So right. My job is to be on standby for all of our 250 officers if they run into any emergency situations. So, of course, as you and I started off, our biggest thing right now is the weather, the heat. We'd be worried about our visitors, our employees that come to the park that are working in this heat, mowing grass, weed eating. So, you know, we're certainly well aware that, you know, heat stroke could be a very big issue with both our visitors and our workers. So that's pretty much how my job is day to day this time.
So Shane, a very complex situation that you manage. Let's take the listeners through the chain of events that led to the situation we have today, and I'm referring to the credentials for becoming a state park ranger and the training involved. And I, you know, when I first got involved with parks, the police academy didn't exist.
Sure.
And I think I remember when I was director attending a graduation of a class, and it was, you know, it was maybe the fourth or fifth class of people that had gone through the police academy. So this was a new thing.
Yeah.
And Bill Boswell went out there to attend a graduation. It was an interesting thing as a young attorney at the time I, you know, had been trained in the law a little bit, but had never attended a graduation of a you know, or commissioned officers. So that was kind of an interesting thing from that perspective. But tell us about what it takes to, in terms of qualifications to be a park ranger, educationally wise, and then what are the essential elements of their training?
Sure. Well, the first priority is a mandatory bachelor's degree. Now, that degree can be in anything, but most of the time, not always, it is very close to a natural resource background. Right. But again, not always. A lot of people come in now with business degrees, things like that.
Or so cultural resources, history, and that sort of stuff.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So a lot what is looked at is your educational background and then your work history. And it is not a, as we talked about earlier, the SIR, seasonal ranger. It is not a prerequisite that you be an SIR to become a ranger, but I would say 85% of us have been. It's kind of, it's most of us do it through college as an internship, but it's also just a good training ground to where you get to know what state parks are. State parks gets to know you and find out if you'll make a good fit. And this is where you want to spend your life. So once you do that, and most of us do not get into it because of the law enforcement aspect. A lot of us, just as me, I had a recreation and a plant and animal science background. And then when I got in it, they said, hey, you have to go to the police academy. And I scratched my head for about a minute and said, okay. So you know, that was not going to deter me from going there. But the issue that most of us go into, we walk in and it's funny, Mark, every time a new rookie class comes in, all these other police officers from cities and counties, they kind of scratch their head and they look at us and go, huh, park ranger, huh? You know, you're not the real police. You're the possum police, squirrel sheriff, things like that. But what has been my joy of the years is to watch most of the rangers go through, and we are traditionally always score the highest academically in the class. Many of us graduated at the top of our school. So number one class ranking within 80, 100. Now they have about 130 officers that go through each school. So when I say we go through the school, you go through what's called a post approved school, police officer standard and training. That is both state and federal, national. So every city, county, state officer has to go through a post approved academy. If we were to hire a ranger that has worked in California state parks, or you know, the first thing we look at is, have you been to a post academy? If he has, we accept our credentials.
Right.
If they haven't, hey, you got to go back to school. Sorry.
Right.
When I started, it was 8 weeks. Probably the first class you went to, they probably only went 6 weeks. Now it's up to 12 weeks. And I will expect that with a lot of the law enforcement reform changes over the last year. I would expect that to probably go to 14 weeks in the next year or two.
Right.
So when we graduate with full police powers, just as all city and county officers. However, our mandate and our jurisdiction is just on a Tennessee state park on land or land that we lease.
Exactly. And then you have your own needs in terms of training for supplemental sort of things, search and rescue, you know, first aid, and our
first priority will be medical. You know, there's, and you'll always have the argument that we just talked about. People say, well, do you really need to be law enforcement? Gratefully enough, it is very small, 4 to 8% of our job is law enforcement, but I feel lots of times it's low because we are there on site almost 24/7.
Right.
But unfortunately, also a major part of our job is medical. So when you end up having 30 to 35 million visitors a year, you've got, 244 acres of land, almost 1,500 miles of trail, you're going to have slips and falls, accidents, sometimes just very bad decision making that folks make when they get out and out of doors. and that becomes our job to come in and to rescue them. So you've got to be prepared medically. So our folks have the bottom licensure for a minimum for rangers, an EMR. It's called Emergency Medical Responder. Used to be first responder. The state of Tennessee Department of Health has changed that. Many of us, like myself, are EMTs. So just like you have in the back of an ambulance, and we have a few paramedics. So we do our own training in-house through the Department of Health, their approval. We have our own medical director, have our own medical protocols, just as any ambulance would have anywhere in the state, any city or county.
You know, I learned early on in parks that many of our areas, I would so far as to say most of the areas, are sort of in remote regions of the state. And I just, you know, picking Fall Creek Falls as an example, when that park was built, you know, there was no fire hall, there was no water right. plant, there was no sewer plant, there were no sewer lines, electrical lines, no emergency services, and to rely on those counties and the powers that be and the governance of those counties to provide those services was just not going to happen.
Sure.
And so when you have, you know, Fall Creek Falls, you may have 5,000 or 6,000 people as visitors overnight, combining the hotel, the campground, the cabins, all those people. And it's just not responsible or safe to go without having those services available pretty quickly.
Sure. Well, and ironically that you say that, Mark, years ago, when Fall Creek was first developed, they ran their own ambulance.
That's right.
The county didn't even have an ambulance. The state was able to pick that up. And so not only did Fall Creek Rangers take care of visitors, but they would go out into the county and assist, you know, because that was a very economic stress county at the time.
That was the point that was the point of building the park, was because it was an economically distressed county.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So, and we strongly rely on, as you say, now fire and search, different rescue, volunteer rescue teams. I mean, we work with them weekly,
right.
and we could not do our job without them. But it is great when I know we're sending rangers out, we've got a licensed, trained ranger medically to take care of our business.
Right. You know, Shane, let's back up just a little bit. And you talked about there being a requirement of a bachelor's degree of some sort. Let me ask you this. Are there schools that are training at the higher education level, are training folks that you have become accustomed to working with or relying on?
Well, it really varies. For a lot of years, a lot of folks have come out of West Tennessee, UT Martin, a lot of those areas, but UT Knoxville. I've worked a lot with MTSU, but of course that's my alma mater. So a lot of them have different forestry or outdoor natural resource background classes, things like that. UT Knoxville has a big forestry natural right. resource. But it's really a gamut. We've seen a lot come from Tennessee Tech here lately from
their
wildlife management program.
Right.
So it's we have a very, very nice, you know, different variety of not really just one area.
You know, when the requirement of a degree first came into effect, or even before that to some degree, is it may not have been required, but it was kind of high on the priority list, so to speak. We began working with Dr. Lavely at UT Martin, as you mentioned.
Sure.
And there are numerous rangers and area managers now that are trained at UT Martin.
Yes. Well, you know, as you said, I was actually on the board. One of the first things that I did, I got with Mike Crawton and several of us on the board, and we actually instituted around 1997 the standardization for the bachelor's degree to be a minimum. And we didn't make a lot of friends. I mean, I made a lot of enemies over that.
Right.
But for years, as you just alluded to, so many of us knew it was a career path. is something we want to do. And we saw the importance of the scholastic end of it, that you could major in these different areas. Right. And so coming into it, there was no, you know, I did not have to have a degree to become a ranger when I hired on, but I knew that would really vastly help me in the interview process.
Right.
And so I already had my degree, and most of us did.
You know, we were pushing for that, and I left state government in 87. Mm-hmm. And big personnel, as it's referred to, would push back every time that we wanted that credential. You wrote a book a couple years ago called Lost and Hound.
I did.
I certainly recommend that to my readers. I don't know, or to my listeners. I don't know whether it's in print or you can actually get that book, but it's a terrific little book of stories about search and rescue situations that you've been involved in. Tell our listeners a little bit about that and your love for those tracking dogs.
Well, how it started, Mark, is Ed Schoenberg and I got called back around 1993, 94 on two lost kids in the Smokies, two different searches. And the first one was for a little boy named Brad Lavies. We were on a search for about a week for Brad, and unfortunately, it was not a good outcome. Brad had actually probably died within the first day, first few hours of him being lost from his parents, and I've actually interviewed his parents.
Right.
He was lost in the Rainbow Falls area and just got separated, got off the trail. The next year, we were called to look for a 9-year-old boy named Philip Roman, and I was actually on the team that got to find Philip, got to carry him out on our back. He had been lost for 5 days, I believe. 4 nights, 5 days.
In the Smokies?
In the Smokies.
Yes.
He had gotten separated from his family on the Cleanman's Dome.
Oh, my.
Got there and got onto the AT. And it got dark, and he ended up down in one of the drainage areas and could not find himself out. So we were able to find him. And, I mean, in the nick of time, I don't think he would have survived another 24 hours. And that was such a moving experience for me to return him to his mom and dad that I mentally broke down crying just uncontrollably. And then on the way home, I just felt, okay, that's my calling, search and rescue. But what is my calling within that calling? And the gentleman that got me on that search was a retired FBI agent named Bob Swabe. S-W-A-B-E. And at that time, he was working for TEMA. So TEMA worked with the National Park Services.
Tennessee Emergency Management Agency.
Yeah, right. Yes. So Bob, he was a former bloodhound handler. He was one of the guys that tracked and found James Earl Ray when he broke out of Brushy Mountain Prison. So he became kind of my mentor, and he got me my first bloodhound, actually, from Brushy Mountain. And so I have used canine from 1994 until now. I still have a bloodhound. And so my overall goal was to find little lost kids in parks, and I've been able to do that. But what happened, so many police agencies would call me and say, hey, we've got this going on. And I ended up having the only canine resource available. And once I started using it, and it certainly didn't have anything to do with me, I just had a really good dog, and she ended up finding everybody I could find, and my reputation got too big for me, and so everybody called me. So I've been lucky to found 285 people in my career, and I had a little surgery that laid me up for about 3 months, so that allowed me to write a book on my canine adventures.
So the book is called Lost and Hound, and, now it's a lot of good stories, let me tell you.
Well, it's not out for publication. I really only wrote it for my grandkids so they would think I was cool at one time. Yeah. And I didn't think I would be able to give away 50 books. Matter of fact, my first order, I only ordered 100 books, and I'm out of books right now. I've been through about 6,000. So,
oh my goodness. So you've had to reorder them from time to time.
Reorder, and I'm in the process of writing maybe a couple more books. So I have learned now you better put them on Amazon or somewhere to get them reached, because with social media, people learn about it, and all over the country, you know, people that I went to high school with. And so Next time, hopefully, it'll be a little more accessible.
Well, maybe if enough people listen to this podcast, you might just get a lot of requests and enough to subsidize another run of publication. So, Shane, what's in the future as far as park rangers and park security and safety is concerned?
Well, man, it's a tough future. As you said earlier, we experienced COVID a couple of years ago, and it really shut down our country. However, what it did not shut down were state, city, county, federal, state parks. We saw visitation marks we've never seen before in our lives. And of course, our kickoff is Memorial Day. And then we, you know, try to hang on till Labor Day. But even with the fall, it's still busy. I mean, every day was Memorial Day. In the example I use to a lot of people, of course, we've got 56 state parks and we've got about 86 natural areas.
Right.
Now, a natural area for me, I explain to people, it's kind of like a small park without a ranger. So it's usually a little spot on the side of the road in a county somewhere, little trail that goes to a waterfall maybe. And it might have 20 cars a week visitation. It was seeing 200 people a day.
Right.
You know, our parking lots wouldn't even hold 20 cars, much less 200. And we just got loved to death. We couldn't really handle that many numbers. And so it stressed us mentally and physically to no ends. But we were able to rebound and we got through it. Our numbers are not quite as high as they were then, but they're pretty high. I think coming through COVID, people mentally had a new love for the out-of-doors. And so they are, again, loving us to death. And that's exactly what we're there for, right. And we appreciate that. But what we have seen, and this isn't just, we've seen a big decline between city and county highway patrol in law enforcement. They are really struggling to recruit people. And I never thought I would see that within state parks, but we're actually seeing our numbers decline. We are not getting the numbers of people interested in interviewing. And it's not really, I don't believe, the law enforcement aspect. It may be the biggest monster that we have to deal with that's always been there is you better be prepared to work weekends. Your days off come Wednesday and Thursday. You know, that's just it. You work every holiday. And that makes it tougher. You know, it's just back in the day, that was just the norm. But there are so many other things that people can do nowadays. It makes it tough to have a family and make it to the ball game when you work on Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, and that is just the life of a ranger. And it's a tough lifestyle to be able to handle sometimes to raise a family.
Right. You know, it used to be that the rangers, the ranger job came with a house. You lived on site in a house provided by the state, and I understand that's changed.
It's changed a little. It has. There are still a few years ago the administration came up with an idea that they would still provide housing, but they would charge you rent. Now the rent was still very cheap, you know, anywhere that you could find. But they offset our pay. So it wasn't really but what folks did is they would go out and buy their own house instead of paying the state. So, which is okay, but it just took a little bit longer. Our bailiwick that I've always felt safety and security is, man, you're right there. You just, when you walked out the door, you were at work. Now some rangers may live 10, 12, 15 miles or 20 miles away from the park, and it takes them just a little bit longer to respond on that end of it. So it kind of causes a little ruffle when people want to transfer. It used to be you just left one house and went to another state house. Now you've got to sell this house, look at buying another house, and then if you have kids in school and spouse. So it just adds another little dilemma that's a little tougher to transfer.
You know, it was interesting we had several people retire when I was director, and it, you know, after 30 years or so in the service, and all of a sudden they're having to go out and look to buy a house for the first time at age 65. And that's not the situation you want anybody to be in.
Right.
So I think that's
actually one of my big jobs, Mark. I don't know if you ever met Bill Cornwall. He was a former manager at Tim's Ford, may have been after you. He was retired from the military. And I met him my first week as a ranger. And he pulled me to the side and said, where are you going to live for the rest of your life? And he sat me down and said, look, son, don't wait for 30 years to look for a house. You start preparing now just because they're giving you a free house.
I do remember the fellow that you're talking about, an old military fellow. He was superintendent at Tim's Ford for many, many years.
And so he really planted that seed in me early. And so I've really tried to do that with young folks through my career, part of the advisement part of the job.
So Shane, one of the things I know that you're involved in is the fellowship among the park rangers, the alumni of the state park system, reaching back to some of the history of our state parks. And I guess state parks are, was it 85 years now?
Yes. 85 years this year. Yes.
Many of the people that were involved in the founding of the system are gone now, but their legacy lives on. You have been instrumental in creating a thing called the State Park Rangers Museum. Tell us about that.
Well, there's a fine line. Some people would look at me and say I'm either a historical interpretive preservationist or I'm a hoarder, one of the two. And I think you go hand in hand. But I inherited a lot of just photos, uniforms, badges, gear, things like that. And just being the conservationist, I never could really find myself to throw things away. So I just held on to them. And as years went past, you would learn that I came up and I became chief ranger pretty early and got to know a lot of the guys that, you mentioned Bill Boswell. He hired all of those guys, hired me, and he was kind of the father of state parks and trained rangers. And one day I was training some rangers and I brought up Bill Boswell's name and none of these new rookies had ever heard of him. And then I brought up Jim Hall's name. Jim Hall spent 44 years at Fall Creek Falls, did every job, and these rangers never heard of him. And I realized we need to preserve our history. So you don't know where you're going unless you know where you've been. We've all heard that. So, I had collected photos, as we talked about the ranger housing, when I moved out of my house on the park at Henry Horton, that's where the chief ranger's office is housed out of. When I moved out of the house, it became vacant. There wasn't really any need for it. So the administration allowed me to turn it into my office, but I turned the front rooms into a ranger museum. So it has a collection of certainly of pictures of police academy graduations, our in-service training. It has a lot of our older uniforms that we used years past. So a lot of throwback stuff. We have a lot of memorabilia that we have in there, whether it's postcards, it's old. I have some of the standing operation policy manuals that come back from the 50s and 60s. I inherited this past week a former colleague and ranger, both of them, they're married now, but retired, Judy Wasick and Alan Wasick. Alan, again, historic preservation or a hoarder, he held on to our Tennessee State Park phone logs or directories, and he sent me 50 years of that, Mark. It's unbelievable of names I haven't heard in a while, some names I've never heard of. And so I'm having a ball going through that.
Scanned.
Yes. So we started the museum, and then I thought, well, lots of times we don't see each other. It's kind of like our own family. We don't see each other unless we go to a funeral. And then I said, you know what? I'm tired of going to funerals of rangers, and that's the only time we see them. Let's have a celebration. So last year, we started a Tennessee State Parks alumni homecoming celebration. And it is not just for rangers and managers. It can be directors. It can be office managers. It can be folks that worked in the hotel, maintenance, anywhere. And we put it on the heels of World Ranger Day. So World Ranger Day usually ends the last day of July. It is a celebration of rangers all across the world. And so we had our open house on, I believe it was July 30th or 31st last year. And we had about 60 alumni show up. And so we, Tim Burris from West Tennessee, who was a former manager at Nathan Bedford, right. And Tim was a legacy ranger. His dad,
his father was a ranger, right?
Yeah, was also ranger manager at Realfoot. So Tim was our first elected president. He passed on the gavel to Steve Pardue. Steve came up through the interpretive side of state parks and then went on to manage Realfoot and later became an area manager.
That's right.
And Steve still is very active of helping Roger McCoy with natural areas do a lot of plant identification, especially in the Big South Fork area. So Steve is our newly elected president. And so we will have another alumni homecoming July the 30th at Henry Horton State Park.
Nice, nice. Ranger Museum, is that something that's open for the public to see?
Sure, it is. Of course, it is our office, so it's open Monday through Friday.
Right.
But we also, myself, other rangers that Henry Horton will also glad to open it up on the weekend and give personal tours of it. It's got most of it is historical, but it has a lot of panels on our new areas of all of our special operations, our search and rescue, our fire response, our medical response. I've got one of the first medical kits that was ever given to a ranger from Bill Boswell to Jim Hall back around 1974, I believe. So I tried to pry that from Jim for many years and he didn't want to give it to him, but he finally did a few years.
Fantastic. Let me ask you this, you know, you are one person and, you know, it's a 9-hour drive from point to point across Tennessee. How is it that you manage to actively integrate with all those people out there in the landscape?
Well, the last time I logged it, I've driven 1.5 million miles in my career. So certainly for the old days, it's just put the rubber on the road,
right?
And put time out there. I'm more of an operational chief ranger. I like to get dirty. I'm usually down in the trenches with the folks when there's major bad things. Now, I have made a lot of good friends with other state agencies. Probably the best one is the Tennessee Highway Patrol and their aviation unit. Mm-hmm. I found out, man, you can fly to a lot of parks really fast, really quick.
If you have the right assistance.
Exactly.
Well, and I guess if you reciprocate when they call, you respond, and when they have a need, I guess they have to reciprocate, don't they?
Exactly. It works right. Well. We've had a great relationship with them over the years, and now they do a lot of our hoist operations. If we get individuals that are 15, 18 miles back in the backcountry and have a very serious injury, maybe even life-threatening, that may take us 6 or 8 hours to get them out. Let's say we had somebody 15 miles to carry out in this heat. We can call the Highway Patrol and they can be there in just a matter of minutes, less than an hour, anywhere in the state, and hoist them out.
Well, you have had a recent event that it required their intervention.
Yes, we've had several.
Okay.
We've had to use them several times over the past couple of years.
Right.
Okay.
So Shane, we were interrupted again and we were talking about rescue and the Highway Patrol folks. And I was about to ask you about the situation at Cummings Falls. And I know that which is an area there just north of Crossville or north of Cookeville, Tennessee. There's been an event or two in that gulch there that have presented some very serious dangers to people.
Yes, the biggest one we had there is July the 5th of 2017. The pilot, Brad Lunn, he called me, and I've worked with Brad many times. He called me and said, asked me where I was. I was in Crossville. He said, get to Cookeville. We have the worst emergency I've ever seen. And Brad has worked more emergencies, many, many more than I have. And he is very cool, calm-headed. And I could tell by the tone of his voice, he was pretty upset. And he told me that we had a very severe flooding. And what had happened, we had a wall of thunderstorm hit north of the park. And I mean, it was beautiful sunshine day that day. And we had about 3.5 inches of rainfall within 45 minutes. And what we think it did, we think it created a log jam and held all this water. And then it broke the log jam and it just flooded the park within 4 or 5 minutes.
Wow.
And it trapped about almost 100 people down there. A lot of them were able to get to high ground, but a lot of them weren't.
Right.
And when I talked to Brad, he told me what was going on, said there was a family that was stranded on a rock. It was a mom and a dad, his mother, and his two kids. And Brad told me what happened, and he was in a smaller aircraft. And I asked him if he was going to go back to Nashville and get his big aircraft to hoist. He said, Shane, these people will be dead in 5 minutes if I don't do anything. Now, Brad and I had to ask him, when we first got Cummins Falls, I just had this intuition of a bad feeling that we were going to have some type of major emergency. So he and I had practiced this several times of going in and maybe picking people off of a rock. We never imagined there would be a whole family. And you can YouTube this and THP Aviation in Cummins Falls, and you will see the most heroic thing you've ever seen within Tennessee of what he does. He flies over, and he has enough forethought to land in the into the parking lot, grab a ranger, actually grab a seasonal ranger. They grab 5 or 6 life jackets. They fly over to the people. They hand them down life jackets. And that move itself saved one of the lives. This gentleman stuck on the rock, his daughter was swept away.
Wow.
And the life jacket, she floated downstream to our rangers who had a rope stretched across the river, and they were able to grab her. And Brad came down and would put his skids down in flooded water and pick one of the families off one by one, take them to the parking lot, drop them off, come back and get the other.
Fantastic.
And so it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. Now, the unfortunate part of this gentleman's 73-year-old mom had been swept away early on into it. She was just too weak to hang on. So we did have a fatality out of it. But that natural disaster could have caused, you know, a lot of fatalities. So the quick action of the Rangers and Brad Lund, Ohio Patrol, was just amazing.
Well, this is just an example of why it's important that there be someone like you to make sure that we're prepared with a response when the need is there.
Sure. It's why we train. It's why we have the equipment. You know, we want folks to come. We want them to come to wilderness areas. We want to have those accessible to them. But we know Mother Nature can strike at any moment, or just accidents can happen. And it is why we are there and prepared and trained the way we are.
Super. Now, Shane, I want to wind up here. We've been going for close to an hour. We've been interrupted a couple times, unfortunately. I guess maybe the heat is what's causing the interference. But I know that you revealed to me before we got started that you're about to retire. Tell us about that.
Well, I've had a wonderful 33 years with the state, several more with the city of Columbia, but I have been Chief Ranger come this July 1, 25 years. That's a long time for one person to be in one position. This job is kind of, if you can imagine, it's really a 7-day a week. I can have a day off, but I still have 250 officers that may need something. And when they call, I'm going to make sure that I'm there to be able to take care of any needs they may have. So it comes to an expense. My family, I've missed a lot of birthdays, a lot of kindergarten graduations because I've been on an emergency of some sort all across the state. So with 9 grandkids, it is finally time that they get a little more of my time, that I introduce them to Tennessee State Parks and camping and fishing and all of that. So I won't be a stranger. I'll still probably volunteer. It's hard to take somebody that's been in the park system this long and have a love for it. And it is a family. A lot of people may not realize it, but, you know, I'll spend more 4th of Julys with rangers than I will with my own family,
right?
Because that's when you work. So it is time for my family to have a little bit more time on that end of it. But I am blessed beyond means of the people and the things that I've been able to do within Tennessee State Parks is unbelievable with my career. I've been so blessed.
Well, Shane, thank you so much for your time today and for letting our listeners know about this aspect of Tennessee State Parks that it is not often known about, and giving us some insight into that. So the next time you go to a park and you see a ranger, you'll know maybe a little bit more about what's behind that ranger hat.
And thank them for what they do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Folks don't realize the many hats that we do wear. So, Mark, it's been my pleasure. Thank you, my friend, for having me on.
Shane, it's been a pleasure, and we'll see you down the road. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Mark. See you, buddy.